Well, I was not a Disney kid growing up. In fact, the first time I ever saw a Disney movie was in high school. I broke my femur, and while I was laid up, one of the ladies taking care of me decided we were going to have a Disney day, and we just watched one after another, which I don't know what your Disney threshold is. Mine was about 3, until it started to feel like all these little dancing, singing animals were conspiring to steal my sanity. So it wasn't until later that I saw one in the movie theater. It was Lion King, which, you've heard of. Okay, so you remember the part, I'm about to spoil the plot. Everybody good with that? Okay, yeah, I know, shocking. You remember when the king lion, the father, Mufasa, falls, and he's not getting up, he's dead? Remember that? I remember watching that in the theater, and between the seats in front of me, I watched this little boy's face turn up to his dad and go, "Why isn't he getting up, Daddy?" And I was like, okay, that's the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm like, Disney, why do that to children? Right? But even more memorable to me was in the movie, the young lion's response, Simba. Do you remember it? Now, the reality is there were larger forces at play in the death of his father in that moment. Yet it was undeniable that it was his willful act of defiance against his dad that contributed to that chaos. And do you remember when that landed on him? When the reality of that I'm a part of the chaos I now see, do you remember his response? He ran, and he lived a different life. Now, was it the worst life ever? Was it a life of crime? No. I mean, he made some little buddies, Hakuna Matata and all that stuff. But he was miles from where he was supposed to be and from who he was supposed to be. And in running, he abandoned a world that desperately needed him to engage. Now, why do I mention that? Because I haven't been in ministry all that long, but I see that play out all the time. Of people saying, I was about the things of God, walking with him, and then something happened. And I'm not the worst guy you've ever seen, but I'm over here. Like, I remember I was at a bar once and talking with this dude that was smashed. We were talking, in the midst of that, he brings up, asks me what I do, and I tell him I'm a pastor. And as soon as I say that, he goes, "Man, I used to be in Young Life." And then he looked at himself like, what happened? Like, I was involved in the things God was doing, and then something happened along the way, and then now I'm here. I remember I was at a store in the mall, a luggage store, buying some stuff for a trip, and the lady asked me, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Venezuela on a mission trip. And as soon as I said that, she lit up and she was like, oh, we used to love doing stuff like that. And then she cut off mid-sentence, broke eye contact, never looked at me again. Said, yeah, my brother still does stuff like that. And it was like you could just see this wave of shame crash over her. That there was a time where I was excited about the possibilities of what God might do with my life. And then something happened. And I'm not the worst human you've ever met, but I'm here now. Or you forget other people, I think about my own life. Like, I don't know if you grew up going to camp, I did. But for me at my camp, first couple days of summer camp, everybody acted crazy. Drinking 40s, climbing buildings. It was nuts. Which none of that's made up, by the way. It was just, I was camping Mississippi. But I remember on Thursday night, man, everybody got saved, right? It was after a couple days, a lack of sleep and malnutritious food had everybody in an emotionally volatile state. And they'd get us all in there and the band would get our emotions all stirred up. And then the speaker would get up and get us all riled up. And by the end of the night, I remember everybody was crying, locking pinky swaying, singing Friends Are Friends Forever. And right at the emotional pitch, it was open mic night. And one by one, we'd get up there. And guys would get up and be like, I just want you all to know, I just got saved. And we're like, didn't he get saved last year? No, don't interrupt him. It's a thing he does. Like, oh, okay, all right. But for most of us, we would get up there and we would offer big promises of what we were going to do for God, met by hearty affirmations from the crowd. I just want everybody to know, I'm never going to sin again. He's had such a good week here at camp. I think it's true. I think it's over for him. I just want everybody to know, I'm going to tell everyone in the world about Christ. He is the next Billy Graham. He is prophesying right now. And on we would all do it. But there wasn't a one of us that 2 weeks later hadn't broken every promise. And we would be back in our bedrooms, surrounded by the same addictions, going, what's wrong with me? So I guess this whole walk with Jesus and him use people in their life is true for some people, but not somebody like me. So I'm not going to be the worst person you've ever met, but I'm just going to live over here. And you go, why are we talking about this? Because the question for today is, what does God think of you? What does God think of you when you are an absolute failure? Well, that's where we're going today. So welcome to Passion City Church. We're going to do it today by looking at the life of Peter. Peter was one of Jesus' earliest and closest disciples. And he was the one that was like all heart but half mind. You know what I'm talking about? Like a ready, fire, aim kind of guy. Which isn't a bad thing to be. Makes a good fullback, you know? You don't need one that's trying to think everything through. I mean, just put your head down and go, man, right? And it works for some people. And so in the middle of Jesus' ministry, there was a moment where he asked his disciples, who do you say I am? And Peter was the only one that had the courage to step forward and say, I think you're the Son of God. You go, that's right, Peter. And yet a moment later when Jesus said, and I'm going to the cross for you, Peter's the one that stepped up and rebuked him. Said, don't you talk about crosses around here, and began to rebuke the Messiah. And Jesus had to give him like a front-end alignment, like you don't rebuke the Son of God. Like, that's not how this works. And when the night Jesus was betrayed, Jesus asked his disciples to pray with him, and they kept falling asleep. Soldiers came in to arrest Jesus. And you remember when they woke up, Peter was the one that pulled out his fishing knife to go to war against him. You remember that? Which is weird, because the text tells us he grabs his fishing knife, but Luke says there were two swords with them. And yet he grabs a knife and was like, get behind me, Messiah, right? And you remember he tries to kill one guy and just hits him in the ear? He's trying to end a dude and gets a lobe. He just wasn't an organized guy. Jesus tells him to knock it off. And they arrest Jesus and they lead him to that courtyard. And Peter and John follow. And there, in the midst of his entire social sphere, with all the adrenaline sapped out, he watches his whole world mock and reject Jesus. And in that context, somebody says to him, hey, aren't you with that guy? No, I don't know him. You sure? Because I thought I saw you with him. Aren't you one of his guys? No, I don't know him. No, you kind of sound like him. I think you're one of his people. No, I don't know him. And just to prove he's not one of those Jesus people, he starts cussing again, like a sailor. And the text tells us not only did that rooster start crowing, it says that Jesus looked right at Peter. And do you remember his response? He ran, and he cried. And there's a lot of shame in Peter when we arrive in our text today. Yet as the text begins, it says, after this, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Now, what's after this? The this is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And he starts appearing to people. So there's excitement. Jesus is back from the grave, but there's confusion. He's not explaining it, but there's hope building. And in the midst of that, an angel comes to one of the women and says, go tell the disciples and Peter to meet him by the Sea of Tiberias. And I think the angel threw in the and Peter, because he probably wouldn't have showed up otherwise. Because he probably didn't think he was invited anymore. This is for the people who are still following him. And I messed up. But they get the and Peter, so he shows up. And yet as we arrive in this text, when he gets there, verse 3, it says, Simon Peter says to them, I'm going fishing. Now, commentators divide on the significance of that. Some people say they're just going to kill some time, have some fun. But it says later in the text they fished all night. You don't fish all night for fun. Some people say, well, maybe they're trying to make some side money. And you go, no, you got to understand who's talking and what they just said. This is Peter saying, I'm going fishing. Like, it'd be like if I came to my wife tomorrow and said the sentence to her, I am going to play basketball. She would get the mental image in her head of me going down to the gym and doing my best to get the ball into the hoop, right? She'd be right. And yet I'm old enough to remember Michael Jordan when he held a press conference after that unfortunate little foray into baseball and said the exact same sentence. I am going to play basketball. No one asked him at the press conference, what do you mean, Mike? Like with your kids in the driveway? What are you talking about? Everybody understood. This is Jordan talking about basketball. This is career move. This is Peter, a career fisherman, just like his father before him, right up until the moment Jesus intersected his life. And Jesus said, put the nets down, Peter. I have a whole new life for you with me. But Peter betrayed him. So Peter gets there and says, you know what, guys? I'm just going to go fishing. I'm not going to be the worst guy you met, but I'm just going to be over here. And I'll be honest, I run into a lot of people like him. What's he do? Does he just become a pity party and just write in his journal all his lost feelings? Not necessarily, although some of us do that. I think for Peter, he does what a lot of us in here does. He just goes to work and gets busy. And I meet a lot of people that the way they wall out the shame from bad choices they made in the past or tragic things that happened to them in the past is they just pinball between busyness and distraction. And so let me get into my work. And it may be good redemptive work, but you just get into the work. Why? To prove you are somebody, to try to silence the voice of condemnation in your head that your mother or your father said to you, or just to wall out the shame from bad decisions you made. Let me just dive into something I feel like I can win at, and when that's insufficient, let me just get something to distract me so I don't have to deal with this. And we pinball from busyness to distraction. Peter looks in this moment and says, man, I don't know how to deal with all this. I'm just going to do what I know. I'm going fishing. And let me take a step away from what God wants to do in my life. And it says in the same text, and his disciples said, we'll go with you. Peter was a leader, and so he influences them. You are too, by the way. You know that, right? None of us sin alone. We all influence people, every single one of us. I remember for me when I was in my mid-20s, I had a young man come to me and said, I need to ask for your forgiveness. I said, what do you mean you need to ask for my forgiveness? And he said, man, he said, when I was in high school, you were one of the youth leaders in my camp. He said, and I was new to this whole Jesus thing, and I showed up there, and y'all were talking about Jesus, and I was starting to believe this is legitimate. And then I came into this rec room, and you and some of your buddies were joking, and you were making some really inappropriate jokes. And I thought, oh, that's really how it is? And he said, and I walked away from all this. He said, and it took me a long time to get back, and I'm not putting on you all the decisions I made between there, but I judged you harshly for all these years, and I'm asking you to forgive me. When he said that, I realized I didn't even remember the moment he was talking about. But I didn't dispute it. But it hit me in that moment. I'm not responsible for every decision he made in life. But my words carry weight. And so do yours. Our lives carry weight. And I talk to a lot of people who say, it's just my life. It's just my decisions. No, it's not. You think there aren't little people watching you? Cousins and nieces and nephews and brothers and sisters that don't look to you for guidance? And so Peter says, I'm going fishing. I'm just going to take this step. And they go with him. And yet I love it. The text says, and they went out and they got into the boat. But that night they caught nothing. That's God's doing. That's God in love jacking with his kids. Because that's what he does. What is he just going to let you go? Would you do that? You had a little niece or nephew running out into a busy street, would you be like, it's not my kid? No! You go after him and you grab him, even if the grabbing hurts. You think God's just going to let his disciples roll off? No, I'm coming for you. You think he's just going to let you run away, someone made in his image? No, he's coming for you. That's what tonight's about. And you go, well, how do I know? Well, let me tell you one way you know God is coming after you. Often he will begin by complicating things. The way you are living your life is not working. And so it says, that night they caught nothing. But verse 4 says, but just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. He's coming for them. But then it says, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Now, why didn't they know? These are guys who lived side by side with him for 3 years. How do they not recognize him? Was he too far away? Text says later he was 100 yards off. Was it his disfigurement? Because we find out in Revelation, he still bears his scars. Is it just disbelief that they're like, I can't believe it was Jesus because I saw him die? What is it? Well, I'll tell you what I think, and I think I got biblical evidence for it. I think they don't recognize him in this moment because of his sense of humor. Because you see it throughout his resurrection appearances. He's constantly messing with people. I mean, you see it one chapter before. Mary goes to anoint the body, and she shows up at the tomb, and the stone's rolled away. So she sees Jesus' body is gone, so she starts crying. And then Jesus shows up and says, why are you crying? He knows why she's crying. And then he says, who are you looking for? He knows who she's looking for. And then she starts saying, well, I'm looking for Jesus. I can't find him. And they start this conversation. You're like, what is going on here? And then John tells you she thought he was the gardener. Why did she think he was the gardener? Well, I'll tell you what he wasn't doing. He wasn't glowing and floating towards her and be like, why are you crying? She's like, I guess gardeners float around here. I'm looking for Jesus. No, he was like messing with the bushes or something. Like, hey, why are you crying? And he just let it ride for a second. And then he was like, hey, Mary. She's like, Jesus, why do that? Right? Or Luke tells us that two of the disciples were walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus, 7 miles. And it says Jesus walked up to him, but they were prevented from seeing who he is. And so he walks up to him and says, hey, what are you guys talking about? And they said, are you the only one in Jerusalem that doesn't know these things? And he says, what things? And so they start telling him about his own death, burial, and resurrection. And for 7 miles, they walk, and he's like, wasn't that to fulfill scripture, though? And he kind of unpacks it for him, and they walk, and it says when they get to Emmaus that he pretended, is what the text says, to walk past him. He's like, all right, well, I guess I'll see you cats later. And he starts to walk off, and they're like, hey, man, you want to come to dinner? He's like, I guess. And he waits right until the prayer moment when he's breaking bread, and he's like, dudes, it's me. And then he disappears. So read the text. They run the 7 miles back, get to Jerusalem, go to the upper room, find the other disciples. Like, we just saw Jesus. He's alive. We walked with him for 7 miles, and he didn't tell us who he was, which was kind of weird. Then he revealed himself and disappeared, but he's alive. We saw him. And while they are explaining this to the other disciples, Jesus appears in their midst, terrifies them, because he doesn't go through a door, just appears. They think he's a ghost. And the crazy thing is, he terrifies them by saying, peace be with you. And then he says, do you have any fish? And he starts eating fish. It's what scholars call an internal proof in the Bible. It's one of the things within the story that helps you know the Bible is true, because nobody would make that up. That he's like, I'm back from the dead. Is that salmon? Can I jump in on that? Okay. Oh, that's good. You should try this, right? You're like, what is that? Why mention all this? Why are we doing this? In verse 5, if you haven't, there's one older translation that says he calls them brothers, which I think is unfortunate. He doesn't use the word brothers. He uses the word for children, and he uses the diminutive masculine form. He calls them little boys. And then he asks them a question, and there's a lot of ways to ask questions. He asks it in a way that assumes a negative answer. When Jesus rolls up on the shore, he says to them in verse 5, little boys, you don't have any fish, do you? The way you're living your life, it's not really working, is it? And I love it. It says, and they answered him, no. And he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you'll find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. Now, some of you hear that, and you go, I've heard this story before. Cast the net in, no fish, switch sides, a bunch of fish. I've heard this before. Well, maybe you heard it here. Maybe you heard it in Luke chapter 7, because this isn't the first time Jesus did this miracle. He does it here, and he did it at the beginning of his ministry on the day he first called Peter to walk with him. And I love the way the movie Jesus of Nazareth does it. I don't know if you're a connoisseur of Jesus movies. They're not all good. Some of the early ones, the acting's weird, so you can't understand the conversation. Like when Jesus first asked Peter to go back out to fish. He was like, but we fished all night and caught nothing. Yet at your will, we will go. And you're like, I don't even understand what's happening. But I love the movie Jesus of Nazareth, because you feel the frustration in those statements. That as Jesus and Andrew walk up to him, they're like, hey, let's go back out and fish. Why not? And he was like, I'll tell you why not. Because I just fished all night and I caught nothing. And they're like, let's go back out again. He's like, I just told you that's a bad idea. And he's frustrated about it. And yet he goes back out there with his brother and Jesus, and they get out there, and he starts fishing. There's no fish, and Jesus is like, why don't you switch sides of the boat? And he's like, oh, switch sides? That's the secret? Fish are over here? Really? Who is this guy, Andrew? Are you serious? What do you do for a living? You're a carpenter? Well, then keep telling me how to fish. And he's just so frustrated until he finally does it, and then there's so many fish he can't haul it in. And I love it, because you see on his face that it dawns on him, God just stepped into my boat. God just stepped into my boat. And do you remember his response? He hit his knees. And he said, get away from me, because I am not a good person. And do you remember Jesus' response? He said, no. No, I came for you. And you're mine now.
And I have a whole new life for you, Peter. Don't miss this. Here in the moment of Peter's greatest failure, Jesus recreates the miracle he first used to call Peter to walk with him. How does God respond to Peter and his failure? He recreates the miracle that sends a message. The relationship is still open. I'm creating the moment of connection again to let you know, Peter, you are not too far gone, and neither are you.
That's why John looks at him, and it says, the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. This isn't Nathaniel's fig tree. It's not Matthew's tax collecting booth. This is for you, Peter. He's calling you, and it's the same with you. How does God treat you in your failure? Is he harsh? Does he yell at you? Some of you think that. Some of you, you hear a voice of condemnation in your head, constantly recounting your failures, constantly repeating the voice of your childhood that called you a loser, that you won't make it. I don't know what it was for you, but some of you hear that voice and you've attributed it to God. You imagine him on the shore with an angry tone. Hey! Get out of that boat! Some of you think he talks that way, but he's not like that. He's playful. He's kind. He recreates the miracle to let Peter know the door is still open. And Peter does something I'm hoping many of you will do today. He stops running away from God and starts moving towards him. And it says that when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. I love that. No more walling off the shame and busyness or distraction. I'm moving towards him, not away from him. Was it pretty? No, he puts on his clothes to dive in the water, which nobody does that. And it says he threw himself into the sea. It's not a dive. It doesn't look pretty. It's a mess, because he's a mess. And John wants to show you that. And I love their playful competition. You see it in verse 8. John writes, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. Said, the rest of us just like rowed 3 times. Come on, Peter, you can do it. Just let him do it. And some of you, you're here and you're like, you know what, man, I am far from God. But I don't know the right words to say. I don't know the rules here. I don't know how to do this. You don't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to look clean. It just has to be honest. It doesn't have to be a dive. It can be a throwing yourself into the sea, and it counts. And so he arrives on the shore in verse 9, and it says, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire, remember that, in place with fish laid out on it and bread. I love that. He's already got fish. He doesn't need theirs. He doesn't need anything you're bringing either. But he invites them anyway, and he says, bring some of the fish that you've just caught. And in verse 12, it says, and Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. What does God do to you when you're a failure? How does he talk to you? Does he whip them? Does he yell at them? Does he shout condemnations? No, he's playful. He's gentle. He cooks them breakfast. Why does he do that? Because you eat breakfast with people you like. That's why. And I don't know what you've been a part of in life. I don't know what your hands have touched. I don't know what your eyes seen. I don't know what's been spoken over your life. I don't know. But all I do know is the heart of God. And in the midst of Peter's greatest failure, Jesus recreates the moment of connection and says, I still want you. And that's what he's saying to you. That's what he's like. I watched an interview not that long ago with George Clooney. And as a kid, he said he would feel so much guilt over his sin and his failure, he would put gravel in his shoes and then put his shoes on and jump off his bunk bed and land on him to punish himself for his sins, because he thought that's what God wanted. That's about as far from this as you can get. That's not what Jesus is like when you're a failure. He's kind. He's gentle. He cooks breakfast. The relationship is still open. So they sit down, and I don't know if Peter was going to be able to eat much. Honestly, I don't know. because he sits him down by a charcoal fire. Now, I don't know if you know this. There's fires all over the Bible. You probably know that. There's fire everywhere. People starting fires all over the Bible for various reasons. Charcoal fire is a very specific word. Actually, only shows up two places in the Bible. It shows up here, and it's the type of fire Peter was warming himself around on the night he denied even knowing Jesus. So Jesus recreates the moment of connection. I still want you, Peter. The relationship is open. It's not broken. But then he recreates the moment of Peter's great failure and says, but we have to deal with this. We got to talk about this. And so he pulls him in. And it says in verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John. He never calls him that. Peter didn't pick it up about the fire. He got it there. Jesus never called him by his full name. It's like when your mama would call you by your full name. Benjamin Clayton Stewart. I got to go, boys. Why? I don't know, but it's bad. Simon, son of John, you love me more than these? Now, commentators divide on what the these are. Some people think it was the disciples. Because Peter, on the night Jesus was betrayed, said, all these other guys will fall away, not me. They'll reject you, I won't. Some people think this is Jesus looking at him and saying, Peter, do you still think you're that tough on your own? You think you can do whatever God requires on your own? You think you can handle life on your own? Do you still think you're that big a tough guy without the need of my grace? Is that still what you think? Other people think, and the grammar allows for it, that these are not the disciples, they're the fish. And Jesus holding up a fish and said, do you love me more than these? I called you away from fishing to be a fisher of men. I called you to be something more with me, Peter. Are you just going to settle for a safe income? Is that all you've got as a vision for your life? What do you love more, Peter? What do you want more? I don't know which it is. Part of me thinks Jesus just pointed at a disciple eating fish to cover both. Like, do you love me more than these? And just kind of gets them both. I don't know. But he says, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, tend my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Now, is Jesus being mean here? Is that what he's doing? I used to think he was. I used to think he was just rubbing Peter's face in it. You love me, Peter? Yes, Lord. Okay, well, it didn't look like it a couple nights ago, so let's run it again. Do you love me, Peter? That's what I thought he was doing. That's how I thought God treated us when we fail. I don't think that anymore. And it's not because I don't want that to be true. It's because I studied this passage. If he wanted to shame Peter, what direction would he point backward? Would he point backward? Backward. But what does he do? He points forward. Do you love me, Peter? Yeah, I know you do. Then let's feed my sheep. Do you love me, Peter? Yeah, I know you do, man. So let's go. Let's move on and feed my sheep. Do you love me, Peter? Yeah, I know you do. So let's move on. Let's feed my sheep. I think what Jesus is doing here is he's saving Peter's life. If Jesus did not recreate this moment of dislocation, then every time a rooster crowed in the morning, it would have been a clarion call to Peter, you're a loser. You're the one who betrayed him. You're the one that walked away. You're the one. And he would have felt that shame, and it would have dominated his present and colored his future. I think Jesus recreates the moment of his greatest wound, not to hurt Peter, but to heal him, and he'll do the same with you. When God begins to move in your life, he will fly forward the hands of grace. The relationship is still open. And yet I promise you, as he draws you near, he will say, we have to deal with this. And he will take you to the moment of your greatest wounds. But Jesus will not put his hands on your wounds to hurt you. He will do it in order to heal you. When I broke my leg, it was my femur and it was severely disconnected. And I remember as I sat in the hospital bed, my doctor came in and said, this little hospital can't handle that severe of a break. We got to take you downtown, but you're not stable enough to put you in an ambulance and move you. I'm going to have to partially set the bone myself. And I said, are you going to knock me out? And he said, no. I said, is this going to hurt? And he said, yes. And I remember as he said that, nurses began to file in and hold my body down. I was like, what is going on? And my doctor, who is a very large man, tucked my foot under his arm, jumped backwards, and then hit my leg. Which was interesting because you think you'd scream, you know? But it was so painful that I just went, huh? And started sweating profusely. But you know what I didn't do? I didn't say, the leg? Really? You could have hit my shoulder, slapped me on the hand, hit me in the head, man. Why'd you have to hit the leg, right? I knew he put his hand there, not to hurt me, but to heal me. And God's going to do the same thing. As you draw near to God, he's going to look at that part of your life. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a statement your dad said to you long ago that you have absorbed and believed in the deepest part of you. That's who you really are. Maybe it's the approval you never got for your mom. Maybe it's that thing you did that you don't want to repeat to anybody else, not even to yourself, but the shame of it haunts you. Some of you, the sins of the past completely determine the way you walk into a room like this, whether or not you make eye contact with us, how you talk, how you speak, what kind of work you do, and how you go about it. Some of us are so dominated by the wounds of the past. They are dominating our present and determining our future. And Jesus wants more than that for you. And so he will take you to this place of wounding, not to shame you, but to take the shame out. Not to relive the pain, but to relieve it. Do you see it? And so he comes to Peter and says, we have to deal with this. Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. I know, so let's move on. Peter, do you love me? Yes, I know you do, so let's move on. Peter, do you love me? Yes, I know you do, so let's move on. Don't let the failures of the past determine your future, Peter. Let's move on. Let's deal with the wound, and some of you need to deal with it, and that will be a process. It'll be moments like this, sitting around a fire with trusted people that you confess the darkness to, that understand you and want more for you. Some of you, it'll be with a counselor. Some of you with dear friends. Some of you, it'll be even tonight as you confess your heart to God, but you sit around fires like this to deal with the pain, and then we rise and move on because the world's full of sheep. That's what Jesus says, talking about us. That's not a compliment. And if you've been in church, you've heard that. I mean, sheep are not impressive animals. They're not. They're nature's victim. Sheep will die of dehydration, like feet from water. And you're like, it's right there. They can't see it. They can't bite hard. They can't run fast. They don't have quills. Even lizards will do the little... And like that red thing comes out, and you're like, I don't want to touch that. I don't know what that is. They don't even have that. Birds will kill them. They're just, and that's it. And Jesus looks at Peter and says, Peter, look at the world, man. He says, pick your eyes up and look at the horizon. There's sheep, man. Look at how dangerous this world is. Look at how many difficult, scary things are in the world right now. And look at our high schools. Look at our junior highs. Look at these kids. They don't have the equipment within themselves to deal with the harsh realities around them. So Jesus looks at Peter and says, so feed them. Take care of them, Peter. Don't get so wrapped up in your past that you're a self-immolated victim and deny helping those I came to save, Peter. I love you. The relationship's open. Yes, this was heinous and we all saw it, but my grace is sufficient for you. So let's heal the wound and let's move on, Peter. Because I want you to feed my sheep. And that's his call for you. You're not too far gone. And he'll put his hand on the wound, not to hurt you, but to heal you, to save your life. Johnny Cash had a great career and got hooked on drugs, on amphetamines. And you can read in his autobiography, he's got a whole chapter dedicated to all the cars he wrecked while he was on drugs. One of them started a forest fire, almost wiped out an endangered species of condor. He's a mess. And he torpedoed his career, alienated his friends and his loved ones and his family. His whole life went up in flames. So in that moment, he looked around and said, all right,
And he went and found a cave. And he got a flashlight and he said, I'm going to crawl as deep as I can into this cave until the batteries on this flashlight go out. And then I'm going to disappear. And that'll be the end of Johnny Cash. That's what shame will do with you. It'll make you turtle up. And he did it. He crawled into that cave, lights went out, and he curled up in a ball and said, that's it. And then he said, the strangest things happened. I felt God in that moment of my greatest shame come closer to me than he ever had and said, no, I still want you. Get up. And he said, but I was so deep in there, there's no way out. So much darkness, I don't even see where to go. But he just started moving. He said, and somehow as I started moving, I saw the light. And I moved towards it. And when he got to the mouth of the cave, two of his friends were there. And he's like, I don't even know how they knew where I was. And they took him to the hospital because he was still hooked on amphetamines. But he began a journey of getting sober, getting healed. And after that, he launched into a stretch of his career where he was doing crusades with Billy Graham, singing about a God who would save even a wretch like me. He did movies about Jesus, about the Apostle Paul. And at the very end of his life, they were playing his videos on MTV where he was talking about the judgment of God on sin, but the grace that's available through Jesus. Put out on MTV. Why? Because he had the clout to show you he had actually lived that story. So I don't know how far you've gone. I don't know how far you feel. It may be a whole life that you had an innocent, sincere faith that got derailed a long time ago. It may be that it's just been a really hard week. I don't know. But you're not too far gone. God rejoices in coming to those who are in the midst of failure, in the midst of shame, and saying, the relationship is still open. I want you. The wound can be dealt with by my grace if you'll let me. I will heal it, so we'll move on. And then join me. And I love it. He looks at Peter, and after saying this, he said to him, follow me. He said in verse 18, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself, walk wherever you wanted. When you were old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. I love that because we're all going to die. You know that, right? No one gets out of this life alive. Death rate's what it's always been. One per person, right? And yet he looks at Peter and says, but your life and your death can bring glory to me. And I want that for my life. I want my life and even my death to bring glory to him. I don't want my life to be dictated by my failures. I want it to be dictated by my faith. That I'm someone who believed he could heal a wretch like me and use me. And so he says to him, follow me. But Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. The one who had been reclining at table close to him and had said, Lord, who's going to betray you? And when Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what's that to you? You follow me. I love that scene because you get the picture that Jesus stands up from the fire. It's time to move on. And he says, Peter, follow me. And Peter looks back and is like, well, what about him? Points at John. And Jesus is like, what are you worried about him for? And he says to him, well, your mama used to say to you when you were in a fight with your brother and sister, but what about them? They did this. I'm talking to you about you. You follow me. Well, I want to, but my boyfriend doesn't want to. Yeah, we're not talking about him right now. You follow me. Well, I want to, but no one else in my work. We're not talking about them right now. You follow me. And you watch what I do with a human life that'll trust me. Last thing I want to say is, I know when you talk about this, some people say, well, man, that's all great, but you don't know what I've done. How can Jesus just wave a hand and dismiss the things that I've been a part of? And let me tell you tonight, that's not what he does. How can Jesus be so gracious to Peter when he denied even knowing him? It's because Jesus didn't dismiss Peter's sin. Paid for it. Jesus can be gracious here because this happened after this. What is this? The death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. He looked at him and said, I know what you did, Peter, and I paid for it. I know what you were a part of, and I buried it, Peter. I know what was dominating your life, and I put it in a grave, Peter. And I'm rising telling you, I've forgiven it, and I'm calling you to move on. And it's the same thing he can do for you and for me if you trust him. If you trust him.